Faster Mai, hello and welcome to this episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. The fear of losing Ballasalla Post Office prompted more than 100 villagers to attend a coffee morning last week to find out about the future of the service. The Post Office Board say nothing is decided, but plans have been drawn up for a self-service kiosk to replace the counter services inside the village newsagents. We hear from the public, post office and politicians on this programme. And in the second half, public sector rents are scheduled to go up 1.9% in April. How does government calculate this rise? We hear from the Infrastructure Minister, Ray Harmer. A fierce debate over the future of Ballasalla Post Office took place at the Village Church Hall last Friday. A consultation is being held on counter services in the area as the current sub-postmaster will step down in March. Post Office bosses met with more than 100 people last week, many of whom were furious about plans to replace the counter with a self-service kiosk. The Post Office Board says it sees no viable future for a counter to continue operating in Ballasalla. Despite this, they're insisting nothing is decided and all feedback is welcome before the end of a consultation later this month. This approach has been described by some as managed decline and is in line with the Post Office's retail modernisation strategy, which was approved by Tynwald last year. I was at the meeting last Friday and spoke to these members of the public.
I'm very disappointed. I feel that the people from the post office here, although they say they're listening, they're not really listening.
Why do you feel that?
Because they've got everything in place to put their new machine and their new technology in the post office, but they've not made any movement to get themselves a new postmaster or postmistress. And if they're not decided, they should have done both those things, so they're ready to leap whichever way they decide. But it's quite apparent that they're not making any initiative to choose somebody to take over from the man who's in the post office.
We haven't been told the full truth by the post office. They're making up decisions themselves, and they're not telling us the truth. It's like a dictatorship, it's not a democracy. There's a lot of feeling, as you found here, that by taking that post office away, they're killing the village, and no one's looking at it, and no one's come to talk to us.
So how will it kill the village?
Because you've got people being looked after going into the shop there. I'm a church warden here, and you see people going in there. You see people struggling even to go into that post office. And to try and go to Castletown, this is a load of rubbish sort of thing.
Hi guys, I'm just from Manx Radio. I just wondered what you thought about the meeting.
A load of rubbish. No, it's all on the post office side. I don't think anything that we've all said in there, I think they'll still close the post office.
Even though 100 people came to a coffee morning?
Yeah, I think it's already a done deal.
Do you feel the same?
I feel the same, yeah.
How would it affect your lives, not having a post office?
Well, I don't do all this...
Awful well, for the old age.
We have a business down in Balfain, and we register all our cars through there. We've got our pensions through there. I mean, we use it every day. You know, it's a must to have. I went into Castletown Post Office last week with my daughter, and the queuing outside is that small, the area. The queuing outside. So why are they shutting this one down? It's crazy.
Do you think the way they're treating it, which is sort of like a business, is all about the bottom line, that's the wrong way of going about things?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah, they're definitely not even looking at the community
anything.
I don't have a mobile phone. I don't do online business or anything. No. I send parcels to my son in England. Who's going to register it when I want to send something? We don't want a machine put in there. The minute they put that machine in there, we know it's gone.
How would it affect your life if you didn't have counter services at Ballasalla?
Well, to be honest with you, I always use the post office for renewal of car tax, driving licences, posting parcels. All right, I'm lucky because I have transport. But there's an awful lot of old ladies in there, not wishing to be unkind, but they don't have that facility of a car. So what have they got to do? Get on the bus. You know, some of them aren't able to walk that much. It's about care. It's not about money. You know, there's too much, oh, well, if you don't make a profit, you've got to supply some services at government cost, which is everybody. We're all paying, you paying, I'm paying. You know, I mean, you're not going to cut the police back because it's losing money.
In the post office's defence, they truly believe a kiosk, this machine, can replicate what people need.
No.
What do you think about that?
I don't believe so, because I think it's about, you know, there's too many machines all over the place. A machine is a machine. It doesn't speak, it doesn't think, it doesn't do anything, only just do what it's programmed to do. We're talking about people. I mean, Bob's, Robbers were on that business for as long as I can remember, and I'm here 40-odd years. I live up at the Ballymode, all right, I've got transport, which is fine. But I just think about the elderly people, and of course this new estate that's coming up. It's a centre part, you know, it is central to the whole village.
I think it just shows the level of support for the post office in Ballasalla.
And are you worried if the counter-based service is to go?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I've got an elderly mother-in-law. And
would it really affect your lives?
It would affect our lives, because it takes away her independence, because she would have to rely on us to go into Castletown. Not that that is too much of a problem, but it just takes away that bit more of an independence, doesn't it?
Simon Neen, CEO at the Isle of Man Post Office.
You've made it clear that nothing's decided, but many here don't share that view. So can you reassure people that nothing is decided?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, first of all, really pleased with the turnout this morning. It does show the passion people have got for the post office and for the service locally. So really pleased with that. Pleased with the questions that came out. It is very much an open consultation. So the consultation is open till the 24th of January. Then that leaves it a week before the board meeting to make a decision.
And that's for everyone to comment.
Absolutely, yeah. We've gone out to all of our stakeholders. So not just customers, the users, the commercial customers that we provide services for, all the postmasters, the National Federation of Sub-Postmasters, we've contacted them. We've contacted some of the local care homes, any sort of local charities that represent it. So we're trying to get as much feedback as possible to inform the decision.
Do you feel the timing of the consultation was perhaps not the most sensible, just before the Christmas period when we're 2 weeks off, basically?
I understand that how some people may have perceived it. In reality, obviously, the existing sub-postmaster gave notice. They have a three-month cooling-off period where they can rescind, so that didn't end until the beginning of December, which doesn't give us much time. But I guess, contrary to some of the perception of that, I thought that the social media and the local media coverage was quite comprehensive over the Christmas period, so I'm not sure that it didn't get the coverage it deserved.
Now, you were pains to say nothing is decided, you've repeated that, but people have said you're not leaving all options on the table because you're not exploring whether other sub-postmasters, other businesses would like to continue the counter service. What do you say to that?
So I think it's important when you do a consultation, you're consulting on a potential outcome, so we've put forward a recommendation.
And that outcome is the replacement with a self-service kiosk?
Change of service to a kiosk and a parcel drop location. So that's based on our experience of the local businesses, experience in other areas where post service has been discontinued. So that's what we've put forward. And I think it's important to put forward a view that then people can challenge, and they can offer up what they think the alternatives are, and then they can be taken into the decision.
And well, there was robust challenge here to the idea of having a self-service kiosk. Will those views be listened to?
Of course, all views will be listened to. That's the point of the process, and I think you've heard from the board members that ultimately make the decision that they'll be taking the feedback very seriously.
Arbury, Castletown and Mallow MHK Graham Crajean voted against the post office's modernisation strategy. He told me the board's mind is already made up.
Well, it's strange that they've said that this is a consultation period and they're going to make a decision at the end of the month, but they've not actually gone out for expressions of interest to see if somebody else would run it on a different basis. So how do you make a decision on the services for a village if you've not gone out for the prime one? Is anybody prepared to run it? And unfortunately today they still haven't answered that question. They're saying, oh well, we can make our decision at the end of the month, that we might go and do that. But
could they not appoint an interim sub-postmaster or somebody just to keep it going for a month or two while they make the final decision?
Well, they can do, but when I was discussing this with them the other day with the commissioners, it was a case of, well, who, because they don't actually have staff themselves, so they would have to go and find staff from somewhere else to do it. Great if they can do that, but, you know, surely it would be better to go and advertise for, you know, put a notice out, is anybody interested in running the post office in Ballasalla? Then you get those people coming in, and then you go and start the negotiations on the terms of the contract, so that when it comes to March, then you might have somebody in place. The longer they leave this, gives us less opportunity to get somebody in place. And they, you know, they talked about putting kiosks in. but that doesn't help the people who they want, who want to get money out of the machines, because the machine won't give them money.
We'll get to the kiosk in a second, but so when the post office come here and say it's not a done deal, do you think they're being insincere?
I think what it is that they've overlooked the one key point of not advertising.
So all options aren't on the table, basically?
No, from this part of the consultation, all options weren't for them to make that decision at the end of the month. Now, it may be just the way that they've come over that they haven't expressed that correctly, that, OK, in when they have their meeting in January, they might go and say, oh, well, maybe we should go out. But surely that should be done early doors. And, you know, to put the consultation period starting just before Christmas is a bit disingenuous to the public.
Now, they've said they don't see a commercially viable future for counter-based services in Ballasalla. That's the board. If they're saying that, and Post Office has got this strategy to run basically like a business when it comes to sub-postmasters, why would they U-turn on their decision?
Well, what they should be doing is, like I said, is you go and see if anybody would be prepared to run a post office as part of their ongoing business.
But they don't think it's going to work as a business.
But then that's somebody else's decision. So if it was you, as a business person, you would make that decision. If you don't put it out there for anybody to express it, you know, why do Spar and the Co-op have post offices? It's footfall. And that's been the whole thing for them, is to get that footfall through. So an individual business, and I know the guy from... who's got the shop in the post office, he's indicated them that he would be interested in doing something. But unless you go out and ask him officially and then get... And what they said is, well, we need to go out and ask everybody because we've got to have an open tender process. But they haven't done that. So yeah. They're confusing their message.
And just finally, it's coffee morning. 100 people came. Does that just show the strength of feeling about the post office in the village?
I think it is, and what they were saying is there's a third of people who use the post office here who don't live in the village. Well, that says something about people who think about using the service here.
Arbury Castletown and Maluam HK Graham Crigeen. A further public meeting is scheduled for next Friday in Ballasalla Village Hall from 7 p.m, where post office officials will again be present and open to questions from members of the public. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. The Infrastructure Minister says a tenant's ability to pay is considered when setting rents, alongside the need for investment and maintenance in social housing. It was announced last week that rents for those in public sector homes will rise by 1.9% from April, meaning tenants will have to pay an extra £1 to £2 a week, depending on their property size. I asked Infrastructure Minister Ray Harmer to explain how this percentage increase is calculated.
Yes, so there's obviously a number of factors that we look at. Obviously, we consult with all the local authorities of what their needs are. We look at what the maintenance needs are. What's very important is obviously affordability. And we look at certainly things as to do with minimum wage and so forth and benefits. We also make sure that we're comparing with other jurisdictions such as the UK to see where we fit and to see what proportion of income is involved, but also rates, and we look at the whole picture of that, but also that's very important is the capital investment that is needed, particularly over the next 20, 30 years. That's also a factor in determining of how, where to pitch the rise.
Is the cost of maintaining, providing and building new social housing one of the overriding factors, really, when it comes to setting rents?
It's one of the factors, but affordability, particularly, you know, lower incomes, is also important. Although, remember, all of their rises are covered by social benefits. But we do look at into the range of factors. It is, if you like, a complicated picture. But obviously, you know, there are a number of huge investments going ahead. And also we have to maintain, because the easy thing is to say, well, don't put any rents up, don't maintain, you have much less money to maintain your properties. You end up having to put them up a lot more in future years to recoup all of the damage that you've done. So you have to manage these in a very sort of sensible way, steadily over the years.
an idea that's been floated, fixed rent setting over a 4 or 5 year period. Now, what would that mean? What would be the benefits of something such as that?
Well, it's a huge benefit because a lot of things we know how much we need to invest. We know how much we need to improve the ability for to make houses better to live in, thermal efficiency and all those kind of things, and to do with climate change, but also to invest in new properties such as in the west, in the Milcrease Court and in the north, and all of these things we know are fixed costs. We know really we've got a much developing our brick system, which gives us much more detail of knowing exactly how much investment is needed in properties. So therefore, we understand what we need to do. We understand inflation these days is a lot more stable. So all of these factors, we're managing our assets over a long period of time. To me, is daft to have this continual annual brickbat fight over 1 year. Much better to say, this is what we need to be doing over 5 years.
And does it give tenants that surety that they know what's coming?
Exactly, and that's what we want to do, so that they can then plan and understand what their rents will be over the next 5 years. That, to me, is a much, much more sensible approach, and really is something that we'll be really pushing for this year.
Housing on the Isle of Man is a sort of a patchwork. There's lots of different providers. What would you say to tenants who may see a rise and feel that their property in their particular area isn't getting the maintenance, isn't getting the investment they need? Is there a bone you can throw to those people to say, well, look, we're trying to improve all properties here with local authority?
Well, yes. For example, all new properties, we're going straight to sort of what we call silver standards. So in terms of actually making sure that they have the right thermal efficiency. So for, you know, Professor Curran, we're talking about all the things of global change, but also fundamentally it makes your fuel bills cheaper. And some of the work that was done in the early 2010s was similarly putting radiators, better thermal efficiency will make your fuel bills and your gas bills and so forth will be lower. So we're putting investment in that. Again, it's very much driven by not just us but local authorities, and working with local authorities on not just new schemes but also maintenance schemes, replacing kitchens and so forth. But it very much is a partnership of working together.
I wanted to ask you about deficiency payments. The estimate, I think, is £6 million. This is the sort of the figure you use to plug the gap. Is this the most sustainable? Is this the right funding mechanism for social housing across the island? Because some people want to see a different system.
I think the concept of a deficiency is right in the sense that we can't be expected for all the tenants to pay that extra £6 million. So if in straight terms, local authority rents, and we're talking about local authority deficiency of around £23 million, if they had to pay another £6 million, then you're talking a 25% rise straight off.
Would you bring it to market rate, which would make the whole thing pointless, I suppose.
Exactly, and that's what you've seen in other jurisdictions when they're trying to do this. You know, in other places they've said, we want to make it all market rate first. And this is all about social inclusion. And some of the work that's been done over the last few years has also seen a complete change in our stock from four-bedroom housing to two-bedroom housing. So the stock has to be adaptable, and we need to invest in the property to make it adaptable to the social needs and to people's needs. So what we're trying to do is meet people's needs. The deficiency is saying, hang on, you need a deficiency because it's not right to expect those that have less in our society to be paying for all of that. They have real needs, and it's right that we address that.
Can you eat into the deficiency, though, without passing costs on to the tenants to make funding of social housing more efficient?
In some ways, some of the investment that we're doing, so for example, particularly on energy efficiency and things like that, and air source heat pumps that we're trying and things like that, they make houses better in the long run. So in the long run, those costs will come down, as I say, on fuel, and the change in our stocks of people, and this is again not just the department, it's working across with local authorities. If we get them down from, you know, the four bedroom houses, it is meeting more their needs in the two bedroom houses, but there always has to be a fair exchange between what the state pays and what the, if you like, the tenant pays. And generally speaking, at lower incomes, the threshold is no more than 30% of your income on rent, which we are below, and then those that can afford more, you know, that becomes part of the factor. But the bottom line is there is always a right balance between what the tenant should be paying, but also what the state is contributing.
Infrastructure Minister Ray Harmer. Onchan MHK Rob Callister has challenged the deficiency payment figures given by the department and the minister, which he believes are misleading. The former Onchan commissioner also believes the DOI should be collecting more information on the incomes of those in social housing and using it to set rents on a tenant's ability to pay. He explained his views to Tim Glover.
It is the same drum that I'm beating because I still believe in introducing a fair and equitable rent system on a very clear understanding of each tenant's ability to pay. And this isn't about the tenants that are on benefits, because I know in the budget almost certainly the benefit, you know, their benefits will increase to match up with the 1.9% being proposed from April 2020. I'm not too bothered about the 4% of tenants that could potentially pay these increases. It's the ones in the middle. I genuinely believe the Minister for the Department of Infrastructure does not have a clear understanding of their ability to pay these increases year on year.
What would be an equitable system?
An equitable system will be a one based on financial knowledge, that having a clear understanding of the amount of income, household income, if you need be, of that household income's ability to pay those increases year on year.
Government has that figure, though, doesn't it, for each house?
You would think they'd
work
have
out,
it.
Wouldn't
you
it?
Would feel they'd have it, but I don't believe the minister has that data when he's using an average of CPI increase year on year. I want to be very clear that I'm not against applying an increase, a rental increase year on year, because the housing costs, you know, do increase over time. But what I do need to understand, and I think the minister and his department has to get a grip of this, is having that financial knowledge for each tenant in order to ensure they can pay these increases, because we can never lose sight of the fact what is the purpose for social housing on the island, and that is for low-income families, low-income individuals, or people who have a particular need, and that needs to be fed into social housing to be given that provision.
In a letter you sent to the minister, you've also accused him of misleading the public and the media over this £6 million figure for a deficiency.
I think he's been very disingenuous. We keep putting that figure into the public domain, and I'm very disappointed that his department continually put in a figure of £6 million. So he says that the figure is going to be £6 million, and that is to cover the cost for housing, for them to make a provision for housing. That figure is absolutely 100% incorrect, and I'll explain very clearly why that's incorrect. If we take some of the data and the questions that I asked from January last year, the minister made it very clear that if we'll take one deficiency year, he said there was an estimate of £6.2 million deficiency for the financial year ending 2019/20. Now, that's fair enough, I get that. But then we have to take into the additional information. We know from written information from the minister that his department is making around £5.3 million of rental income. We then have to subtract the actual cost for running that housing, which is absolutely fine. But based on the minister's own information, in 2016-17, the department made a surplus of £3.9 million, and the department made a surplus of £3.5 million in 2017-18. So when you... The minister also said in Tynwald, in a written answer I asked him in Tynwald, he clearly said that those costs were offset against the surplus amount. So if you subtract one against the other, I think if you go back a couple of years, the actual deficiency made by the department to local authorities was less than £400,000. If you take the next financial year, it was £2.5 million. Certainly nowhere near the £6 million that the minister and his department is continually putting into the public domain, which is not just misleading to the general public, but also to the media and also to the tenants that are actually struggling to find this extra cost every year. I understand that we have to lower that deficiency amount.
It's not just this minister, is it? Because this is going back historically within the Department for Infrastructure.
Absolutely. I absolutely picked the previous minister up, Phil Gorn, on the same topic. I don't understand why the department needs to actually keep hammering a figure of £6 million, or even more. I think the figure originally, going back a few years, was £8 million. These are investment in our housing stock. I think we all accept that we have to invest in social housing. We need new estates. And we've got some brilliant examples of that in Douglas, Castletown, Ballasalla and Ramsey. And we will need further investment in our housing stock, existing housing stock. I get that. I understand the government has a duty to invest in this. But let's be absolutely factually correct with the data. Let's not try and say that, you know, tenants are not paying their way. They are paying. And we've got to be mindful as well that a social housing tenant pays for life. They don't stop paying at 20, you know, at 55 or 65 when the mortgage finishes. They pay for life. And yes, they do pay a lower amount. But again, the reason they pay a lower amount is because this housing stock is meant for low-income families or individuals with special needs that can only be catered through social housing.
Onken MHK, Rob Callister. Well, that's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this episode online via Spotify as a podcast. But for now, Gurumayu and goodbye.